with the development of radioisotopes and radiation therapy in general, there arose a number of highly inventive mechanisms by which to deliver radiation. This is the case, of course, still today. There are many different forms of brachytherapy being practiced. There's a great increase in the interest, in particularly in protons, but also in heavy ion centers around the world. Cobalt-based therapies are still popular, particularly with respect to the gamma knife. And the main workhorse in radiation oncology, the linear accelerator, has been reinvented in many different forms to give advantages to the particular way in which delivery is optimized. Brachytherapy, of course, is based upon the fact that implanted seeds will have a physical advantage in the sense that the dose will fall off more or less with 1 upon the square of distance, and therefore implants should at least be able to deliver a much higher dose to the center of tumors with a sharp fall off towards normal tissue. So the potential other radiobiological advantages of brachytherapy include possibility of varying treatment times. Shorter treatment times might be able to prevent tumor repopulation, whereas the longer treatment times could cause cells to redistribute into the more sensitive phases of the cell cycle or allow reoxygenation with time after implantation. There are certainly a variety of sources that could be used for implants or for high dose rate treatment. The ultra-low dose rates are in the order of 0.01 to 0.3 gray per hour, are typified by I-125 for palladium, cesium and radium are less commonly used these days with a relatively low dose rate, whereas the high dose rate can be given to over 400 gray per hour at 1 centimeter. So the treatment time for high dose rates can be in the can be in minutes to hours, as opposed to the permanent implants. There's a very wide range of physical features which are given by the use of different isotopes. Radiobiologically speaking, low dose rate obviously differentially spares late responding tissues compared to early responding normal tissues and tumors. At high dose rate, of course, this therapeutic benefit is not going to exist. However, there are other advantages for high dose rate, particularly patient convenience, the minimizing the risk to staff, and the better dosimetry that can be achieved with high dose rate afterloaders than with low dose rate implants. It's worth remembering that whenever one looks at dose rate, it's certainly true that the survival curves tend to flatten out as dose rate decreases. However, it's also true that there is an inverse dose rate effect that can exist. This inverse dose rate effect is not seen with all cell lines or all tumors in preclinical studies, but certainly exists in some cells. The explanation of the inverse dose rate effect is thought to be that cells will enter into radiation-sensitive phases of the cell cycle. The concept here is that as the dose rate is dropped, then cells will tend to accumulate in G2, which is a more radiation-sensitive phase of the cell cycle, than the other phases. In other words, decreasing the dose rate actually results in increased cell killing. This contrasts with a normal situation where the survival curve becomes progressively more shallow as the dose rate decreases and the shoulder will disappear. This is due to repair of sublethal damage. So again, just as for single or multiple doses of fractionated radiation, even with continuous radiation, the same determinants hold, the same 4 Rs are important in terms of the response. As far as modeling is concerned, for low dose rate exposures, one tends to use a formulation where redistribution and reoxygenation are combined into one parameter, which is resensitization, because both of these essentially are going to result in sensitization of tumor. So the linear quadratic model has essentially been modified to account for a resensitization phase. This is an assumption that this is a valid process, but certainly it's a useful kind of approach in order to be able to do mathematical modeling. So the mathematical model is given by a number of different parameters, which are shown in the next slide. There's one track killing, two track killing, this resensitization parameter, and also a parameter for repopulation. So in order to use this model, one has to come up with some reasonable kind of parameters, not only for alpha and beta, but also for TPOT, the time for repair, time for resensitization. These have to be estimated for the different types of tumor on normal tissues. So here are some kind of examples of potential parameters that might be plugged into the equation that we just mentioned. And using these kind of parameters, it's possible to devise systems, for example, which will show the inverse dose rate effect and will give reasonable estimates to experimental data. One can also use these parameters to work out what the effect of varying the dose rate is in terms of gray per day and how this will influence the therapeutic benefit. One does these kind of calculations, one can work out that depending upon what parameters are actually used, there tends to be a golden zone, if you like, where the therapeutic benefit is present between a certain range of dose rates. One can also look at the effect of a slow-growing tumor as opposed to a fast-growing tumor, for example. In this case, using I-125 implants with a dose rate of 1.68 gray per day, one can see that actually a fast-growing tumor is very likely to outstrip the effects of radiation. For some of these radioisotopes, it's quite difficult to actually do really good physical dosimetry. The spatial distribution of dose, for example, is certainly an advantage in the sense that there is a dose falloff, and this can be used to optimize dose distributions. However, this varies with time as the isotope decays. The RVE might not be exactly known. For example, for I-125, it's quite hard to estimate what the exact RVE is. Dose inhomogeneity is another issue. This can be particularly severe in brachytherapy. And again, this can be associated with dose rate effects as well as total doses. This inhomogeneity, ironically, may be beneficial when the implant is suboptimal and the tumor is rapidly growing, because one might actually end up with fairly high doses of radiation being delivered. But the bottom line is that giving adequate tumor dosage to the whole tumor is in all cases paramount, as is in all forms of radiation therapy. There is enormous appeal in having good physical dose distribution, and protons, of course, are greatly touted as one of the major ways in which to acquire this desired effect. produces largely the Bragg Peak, which is a very sharp fall off of dose after the Bragg Peak. The disadvantage, of course, is that the Bragg Peak tends to be relatively unidirectional, and there is a need to spread out the bed Bragg Peak in order to get adequate tumor coverage. This can be done by active scattering using deflecting magnets and scanning, or by passive scattering. There are differences between these two approaches, in particular with respect to the highest energy secondary neutrons that can result. Inevitably, in order to use protons effectively, one has to know very precisely where the tumor margins are. There are some tumor density issues with protons. The big disadvantage is there are no randomized clinical trials, and probably unlikely to be any randomized clinical trials in the near future. The biological properties of protons are not all that dissimilar to X-rays in the sense that the RBE is in the order of 1.1. However, again, this actually may vary and may be as high as 2 at the distal edge of the Bragg Peak. In spite of the cost of protons and some skepticism in exactly how many different tumor sites these are going to be of superior to LINAC treatments, there are a large number of facilities now operating, and their number is growing very rapidly. There certainly is some evidence for clear efficacy in cases of like choroidal melanoma, some spinal cord and brain tumors, the sphenoid sinus tumors. However, they're also being used for a wide variety spectrum of tumors, for example, prostate, lung, breast, head and neck. And here it's harder to see the positive advantages of proton administration. Heavy charge particles have been around a long time, first in the Lawrence Berkeley Livermore labs. They were used to treat AVMs. At that time, these beams were contaminated with protons and with alpha particles. And there were issues in terms of exactly what dose was being delivered. These particles, of course, will have different biophysical properties. Helium ions tend to have similar properties to protons. Carbon ions have the advantages of high LET, which have less oxygen dependency and cell cycle dependency. However, the RBE increases strongly with LET, and therefore depth and depth doses are hard to calculate. An additional advantage may be the ability to use PET to actually image a target volume. Currently, there are only a couple of heavy ion clinical facilities which are operating. But very good efficacy has been reported in a number of specific sites. There was, again, a lot of interest in neutrons in clinical radiation therapy, which has waned in recent years. This was started 1930s, 1940s at the Lawrence Berkeley Livermore labs, where cyclotron neutrons were used to treat 240 patients. Unfortunately, the wrong RBE was used, and many of these patients end up with very severe late sequelae. Neutrons were, however, taken up again in the late 60s and 70s. The advantages were seen to be a reduced influence of hypoxia, a reduced influence of repair, reduced cell cycle differential, and a higher RBE for slowly cycling tumors. Initially, there were a lot of problems associated with the poor depth dose distribution of neutrons. This was compensated for to by a certain extent with time. There were a lot of studies done to look at the biological effects of neutrons in preclinical models. This is some work from Withers showing the lack of dependency for various size effects on total dose per fraction. In general, however, the results have not been terribly encouraging for neutrons. The high incidence of late complications, the depth dose distribution has always been a bit of a problem. Reoxygenation in conventional therapy may actually reduce the importance of hypoxic cells, and this may not be the case for neutron therapy. It probably is also true that there was poor patient selection. But even with that, there were some limited efficacy, in particular in salivary gland and prostate tumors and soft tissue sarcomas. Boron neutron capture therapy is a very appealing concept. The idea with boron neutron capture therapy is that thermal neutrons can excite boron, resulting in the production of alpha particles. One of the biggest problems with this is that one has to get enough boron into the tumor in order to be effective. There's been a variety of very inventive kind of approaches proposed. However, this is still an issue. The other issue is that thermal neutrons are relatively poorly penetrating. The boron neutron capture therapy world has tended to produce a fairly interesting number of largely anecdotal studies, and there are a few sites currently conducting boron neutron capture therapy. A much more attention has been paid to stereotactic radiosurgery and stereotactic radiation therapy. The difference between these two is that SRS, the radiation, is given in one fraction. This was first proposed by Lexell back in 1951. The problem with SRS is that it loses the advantages of dose fractionation. And in many centers that started off using SRS, have ended up going to fractionate with SRT. One might say that there's a growing interest in hypofractionation, in particular with SRT, as it becomes clear that the number of tumors which have markedly differ from the normal tissue in terms of the alpha beta values is probably less than we thought perhaps a decade ago. However, it's still clear, I think, that from a radiobiological perspective, there are differences between large fraction sizes and single very high doses. And exactly what is the best size to use for hypofractionated radiation therapy is still a matter of conjecture. Probably the greatest advance in terms of the physical delivery of radiation therapy is IMRT and related conformal types of procedures. The idea of a sharp dose fall-off to organs at risk is very appealing in radiation therapy. The concept of potentially reducing morbidity is extremely exciting. Of course, it does raise lots of questions. How does one best define gross tumor volume? The issue of geometric miss becomes a problem as the margins decrease. In fact, with IMRT, in many cases, you are actually giving a higher volume, what is essentially a lower average dose. So, in fact, the total dose, the integral dose, can increase, increasing the risk of cancer induction. And there are real issues, in particular with pediatric patients, as to whether one should deliver IMRT. Another aspect for IMRT is, of course, there is increased time for delivery, and this may decrease efficacy. There have been a flurry of papers in recent years dealing with the approximate doses to tissue outside treatment volume, given different forms of radiation. And as you can see from this slide, there certainly is the potential, at least, using things like IMRT and brachytherapy to give fairly high doses to areas which may be at risk. These doses also come, of course, from the increased use of imaging in order to define the treatment volumes. And imaging itself has the potential to deliver fairly significant doses of radiation. For example, cone beam CT in IGRT treatment planning can deliver up to 0.1 sieverts for every scan that is being given. A potential advantage and a potential disadvantage as well of IMRT is the use of non-homogeneous dose distributions. On a positive side, if these are used effectively, it might be possible to use dose painting. For example, of hypoxic regions or PET-positive regions, and deliver a higher dose to these areas and a more modest dose to the rest of the tumor. This can also be used to accelerate treatment using, for example, a simultaneous boost technique. A simultaneous boost technique can actually result in less dose being given to non-targeted tissues. So the final thoughts here are really, where is the physical delivery of radiation therapy going, and how does this relate to radiobiological considerations? How much more are we going to gain by pushing the limits of conformal types of therapy? Will the gains that are made will ever be properly evaluated? Certainly there are economic issues which should be considered. And the final thought is that the greatest gain of all may come from actually approaches in the imaging, because it's extremely important to make sure that we actually hit the tumor with radiation. From a radiobiological perspective, there is much that needs to be studied. The tendency to give less fractions and to increase the fraction size is all very well. However, the reality is that we really know very little about what is the optimal dose to give in a hypofractionated regimen for different tumor types. The normal tissue exposure, which we refer to, which seems to be increasing in many types of radiation delivery settings, is a concern, and again, this needs to be fully evaluated.